Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage for Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alamdi Alanion.
I am Rahmatullah Sheikh.
And I'm Alex DeBoer. It's Thursday, February 22nd at 5:09 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's show features the voices of Indigenous activist and hereditary chief Ernest Alfred from the Namgis Nation, as well as the world-renowned scientist and CBC broadcaster David Suzuki. Both spoke at a wild salmon fundraiser and educational evening in the Unitarian Church in Vancouver last Friday.
After that, we'll hear original reporting from Tuesday's National Day of Action on Drug Decriminalization. This was held at Victory Square Park in Vancouver's downtown east side. This year's action was focused on the criminal justice system and its impact on drug users, including red zoning, a practice whereby individuals accused of low-level drug offenses receive pretrial orders prohibiting them from entering particular geographical areas. But first, we have headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
All right, so first up, City Councilor Hector Bremner visits the downtown east side. Bremner, a nonpartisan association city council member and mayoral hopeful, spent last Friday night with Vancouver police on a ride-along. This took place between 9 p.m. and 4 a.m. The first half of the evening was spent in the downtown east side, patrolling alleys and walking through SROs, which are single room occupancies. Bremner was apparently quite shocked that taxpayer-subsidized housing went to such decrepit living situations. He noticed a lot of... while he was there, he noticed someone overdose, which was pretty traumatic. It was a 21-year-old individual, very sad. Bremner was elected in October to replace Vision Vancouver's Jeff Meggs, and Bremner announced last week that he'll be seeking the party's nomination to run for mayor. So a little background on Bremner. He used to work for Housing Minister Rich Coleman. The NPA, Bremner's party, the nonpartisan association, has received criticism for opposing an increase on property tax to pay for more opioid services. Bremner also did recently vote against Vision's new housing plan, which would see more social housing built. And Bremner was quoted as describing in Metro News the downtown east side as a very broken part of the city. So he's received, I think, a bit of criticism for his sort of perceived naivety on this. Hmm.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah. Next up, we have a story, credit to Metro News. Vancouver nonprofit Atira set to manage a downtown east side SROs. So the Regent and Balmoral Hotels on East Hastings Street near Main Street have been signed over to Atira Women's Resource Society for a six-month management contract. The Balmoral Hotel was shut down last June while the Regent has remained open. Both single-room occupancy hotels are owned by the Sahotas. Atira is a nonprofit society that runs several social housing developments in Vancouver. They plan to set up a shared drug use room at the Regent Hotel for tenants. The nonprofit also intends to implement a 30-day ban on guests in order to identify people who are actually tenants from those who are simply staying there. Currently, about a third of the people living at the Regent are not tenants who have signed a rental agreement. They instead pay an hourly to staff rate to use rooms and hallways. Atira intends to address pest and security concerns, but is not responsible for major building repairs due to short management lease.
Yeah, that's a lot to take on. I would not want to be taking over the Regent and the Balmoral in the conditions they're in.
Yeah,
so,
I wouldn't either.
Good for Atira.
Yeah, I think we were going to talk a little bit about the BC budget, right? 2018.
Yeah, hot news coming in from the world of economics
hot news.
And business. Yeah, quite. Okay, so the BC NDP government has outlined its budget. This happened 2 days ago on February 20th. Now, the budget delivers on campaign promises that centers around their ambition of making life more affordable in BC. We'll further have a look how that's going to be possible or whether that's going to be possible at all. So now, while the budget includes more spending on education, health and social programs, it also increases revenue through new taxes aimed at the housing market. What those new taxes are or what that one new tax is something that we'll discuss very soon.
Yeah.
And here are a few highlights of that proposal. Now, first up, the new tax that we've all been listening about and looking at on Twitter especially is speculation tax. Now, BC is the only province to have this tax. It's going to be an annual property tax that will apply to foreign and domestic homeowners who do not pay income tax in British Columbia, including those who leave their properties vacant. So if you have a vacation home in British Columbia but don't necessarily live here, that's bad news for you. In 2018, the tax rate will be 0.5% of the assessed value of homes. The assessment had come out recently. And in 2019, that's next year, it'll be 2% of that assessed value. So the big question is, where does the money really go once it's been generated through these taxes? We'll discuss more on that later. Secondly, we've also had an increase in the foreign buyer's tax. Now, remember, the foreign buyer's tax already exists. It came out recently. It's at 15%, but since yesterday, it now stands at 20%. So an increase of 5%. Olamide has something to add here.
I don't have anything to add. I wanted to ask a question. What is the foreign buyer's tax? Like, what's it intended to like do? What is it supposed to curb? What are these two, the speculation tax and the increased foreign buyer's tax? What is the NDP trying to really tackle with these two policies?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, is it just for foreign buyers, or is it also targeting residents of British Columbia who own multiple homes but don't necessarily populate them with tenants, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good question.
We'll talk about that later, probably in the show, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
we're gonna have a special guest.
Yeah, we have a special guest. We have a senior economist who'll help us unpack these things. Some good news if you're a student and if you're house hunting like most of us here in UBC. Now, this new budget is going to allocate $450 million to a new student housing program that will allow public post-secondary institutions to borrow from government to finance student housing projects. Now, this is something that was not previously allowed in British Columbia. The objective, they state, is to house more students on campus closer to their classrooms. Interesting. Yeah, the next one on Indigenous languages. Now, it's going to get a financial boost. $50 million will be given in this fiscal year alone for programs that help support and revitalize Indigenous languages. Now, British Columbia is home to 60% of First Nation languages in Canada. Lots of questions surrounding that too, but I would say a really good start to revitalize those Indigenous languages.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see which languages are prioritized, or if each gets an equal amount of resources, or if the resources will be allocated depending on how many speakers there are or how endangered the language is. Be interesting to see.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And I think part of the budget also has MSP premiums being eliminated by 2020, right? Mm-hmm. I think as part of the, actually right here, it's as part of the elimination process, the province will put in place a new payroll tax, employer's health tax, for employers starting on January 1st, 2019. There are tax brackets. Businesses with payroll more than 1.5 million will pay a tax of 1.95 on their total payroll. Businesses with a payroll between 500,000 and 1.5 million will pay a reduced rate, and those under 500,000 will not pay any of that at all. So those are pretty interesting things to look at. Other important initiatives under the new BC NDP budget are child care. There's a $1 billion investment in child care in the province. It is expected to apply to 86,000 families in the province. Creation of new child care benefit worth $1,250 per month and per child starting September.
That's getting a lot of media attention.
Yeah, that's
childcare.
Exactly. And there's an increased luxury tax on passenger vehicles. There's an article, I think, in the in CBC about like how people might possibly move their buying of very nice cars to other provinces or abroad, probably because Vancouver is known as like a very, very nice haven for luxury cars.
Right.
So that might be interesting to see. 15% for cars worth $125,000 and $149,000, and 20% for cars worth $150,000.
We're looking at you, Alex DeBoer.
Yeah.
Yes, I take the bus, so...
Province will also freeze ferry fares, on three major routes linking Nanaimo and Victoria to the mainland.
Hmm.
Yeah, that will also be fun to see. More than $1.5 billion laid out for healthcare related spending, so we already talked a little bit about that, but more initiatives, improved care for seniors, such as increased hours of residential care and money to help residents find a family doctor. There's also budget set aside $72 million for wildlife recovery, wildfire recovery, and resiliency activities. So,
that's only going to be on the rise going forward with climate change, so important to note.
Yep. Quite a holistic plan. Yeah. We're going to have a guest on the other side of the break, I guess, once we go in. So who is it that we're going to be speaking to?
We're going to be speaking to senior economist Iglika Ivanova of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. We had her on the show about 2 weeks ago, actually. So it's very nice of her to join us on short notice as well. So stay tuned. We're just going to have a very quick break, and then we will be back with Iglika to help us break down this complicated 2018 budget.
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
Miss Beth Ditto, frontwoman of indie rock band Gossip, on March 28th at the Imperial. Ditto will be performing tracks from her debut solo album, Fake Sugar, with special guest Shun. Tickets are available now at livenation.com.
In the Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House from 5 to 8 p.m. to examine how power and privilege shows up in makerspaces and explore strategies that support more inclusive and equitable initiatives. Go to diversityandmakerspaces.eventbrite.ca to register for this event, and there'll be free food.
CITR 101.9 FM and BC Black History Awareness present Black History Month. We're featuring stories about extraordinary Black Canadians. One such individual is Emma Stark, the first female Black teacher on Vancouver Island. For her parents to make it to BC, they faced incredible challenges as pioneers. Emma's mother, Sylvia Estes, was born into slavery in Clay County, Missouri. In 1958, Emma moved with her family to Canada after alarm about the pressure from the South to make California a slave state. The family traveled with their herd of cattle through a storm so rough that they had to throw 40 horses overboard. Emma would have been just a toddler when she arrived on Salt Spring Island. At the age of 18, in August of 1874, Emma Stark was hired to teach in a one-room schoolhouse in the Cedar District, becoming the first female black teacher on Vancouver Island with a salary of just $40 a month. She was a dedicated educator, even housing children that lived far away. This has been a PSA made in cooperation with CITR 11.9 FM and BC Black History Awareness. Are you here because of me? No, I am here because of your light. Planets
reach for immortality. And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Alamdi Alanyon.
I'm Rahmatullah Sheikh.
And I'm Alex DeBoer.
Yeah, there you go. Joining us in the show is Iglika Ivanova, an economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. With her help, we'll try to unpack the NDP's 2018 budget and bring you the key highlights and features to note. Thank you for being here, Iglika.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Cool. I think we'll start with Rahmatullah asking the question.
Yeah, Iglika, I think you've been really working hard to unpack this whole thing. Tell us what your key impressions are of the 2018 budget by BC NDP.
Well, this was a very action-packed budget. Definitely a lot of big measures introduced. The two priorities for government clearly are affordable housing and childcare, and those are the ones that got the most funding and the most new measures in this budget. They're both very exciting. On the childcare front, what we're seeing here is the foundations of a new universal accessible childcare system in BC. And that essentially is the first new social program we have introduced in this province in more than a generation. That's not something that happens every day, not even every decade. So it really is a milestone for BC, and it's going to help a lot of families who have been struggling with affording the exorbitant fees for childcare currently that run much, much higher than university tuition.
And why do you think childcare is such a priority?
Childcare is a huge priority because there's a real crisis with both affordability. Again, for a young child in Vancouver, the cost can run up over $15,000 a year, and that's just the median. So half the parents pay more and half the parents pay less. And on top of that, there's not enough spaces. So people often have to wait on a lot of wait lists and often can't find a spot. So they have to choose between sending their child to unlicensed provider where there's no monitoring, no safety standards, or giving up on their career and staying home to be a stay-at-home parent. It's a really difficult choice, and a lot of parents have to make it. So I think it's really good to see some action on this front. BC is behind many other, Canada in general is behind many other countries in this area. We know that the early years are key for learning and development, brain development, social development. And yet we invest very little public dollars in early education. So this budget is about to change that.
Cool. Right. Yeah. So we did speak about education. So we spoke a little bit about childcare. But then one of the features of this budget is also taxes on people who have vacant homes but do not pay income taxes in BC. This could be about vacation homes especially. But do you think this vacancy tax targets foreigners? What about BC residents who may own multiple homes but don't really have any tenants populating them?
So you're right. The measures on the housing side that tackle the real estate situation in BC are also very notable. And we're seeing here quite a few tax measures on the housing side. And the aim of those measures is to reduce speculation and rein in a bit the exorbitant price increases we've seen in real estate, in Metro Vancouver specifically, but not just in Metro Vancouver. We're starting to see it in Victoria and in the Okanagan. So there is four different taxes or tax changes. The most notable one, and the one you talked about earlier on the program, is the new speculation tax. That's what it's called. And the goal of this tax is it targets both foreign and domestic property owners. It doesn't matter where you're from.
Right.
What that matters is whether or not you own a home that is essentially unoccupied. So there is an exemption for primary residences. So if this is your primary residence, the tax does not apply. And there is an exemption for long-term rental. So if you're using your property to rent on a long-term basis, then the tax does not apply. However, mm-hmm. if you're using the property to Airbnb or if it's sitting empty, then a tax would apply, and the tax will, you'll be able to deduct from the tax any income tax you have paid in British Columbia. So if you're working here, then you likely will not be paying the tax. I mean, depending on how many houses you own that are Airbnb. Mm-hmm. But if you're not working here, if your money is coming from somewhere else and you're investing it in the Metro Vancouver housing market, you're going to see a new tax. And so the idea of that tax is not as much to raise money for government as it is to incentivize property owners to rent their right. properties on a long-term basis, and that's to help their situation of very low vacancy rates mm-hmm. in rental. And then if they don't wish to rent them, then it does raise money for government that can be invested in, you know, building affordable rental.
Cool. Thank you. So where is the money that is being collected through these new taxes, the speculation tax and the increased empty homes tax, where are they going to? What is the NDP plan to use with this increased revenue?
Well, the revenues are all going to general revenue, is where all of the tax revenue goes. But there's also in this budget significant investment in affordable housing. There's about $1.6 billion. Over the next 3 years in building new rental properties, in building new student housing, as you mentioned, housing for women and children escaping domestic violence, housing for seniors. So a wide variety of new affordable rentals and other social housing being built. But I think what's significant about this budget, when you think about the housing plan and the taxes specifically, is that the government's recognized that, you know, we've seen incredible windfall gains in property values, in land values in this province, and they're starting to look at property as a tax base more seriously, because this budget also introduces a sort of a progressive property tax. It puts on a third tax. On the property tax, annual property tax for those who own houses valued at more than $3 million. Mm-hmm. So if you own an expensive house, you're going to pay a slightly higher property tax on it. And also when you sell that house valued over $3 million, right. you're going to pay a higher property transfer tax on it. So we know that wealth inequality is very high in our province, and this is sort of an attempt to have a progressive tax on land wealth,
right?
Which I think is something that that is very positive.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of wealth inequality, what effect will this have on the working class family? Is this budget catering to working class families, especially indigenous families, as they are the demographic with the highest growth rate?
One of the highest growth rates. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. The affordable housing and childcare package is definitely going to make life more affordable for many families who are working and who are currently having trouble. It's not going to happen overnight, obviously, with the childcare. Even though there is an ambitious plan to increase spaces, they're still going to take, you know, a little while to come in. Even the benefit that's been introduced doesn't come in until September. So, you know, it's going to take a little while for these benefits to be filled, but fairly soon there will be significant help for those working families who were completely ignored by the previous government. I mean, we have seen, we haven't seen so much ambitious investment in priorities that matter to ordinary people for a really long time.
Right.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Speaking of healthcare now, so MSP premiums will be completely eliminated. They're going to fund this through tax breaks to employers. But is the government losing out on revenue by making this move? And if they are, then how do they make up for it?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, and that was one of the surprises of this year's budget, the announcement that MSP will be eliminated in 2020. And the reason why it's a surprise is that we currently have an MSP task force that is still working on their final report. And so the MSP task force was supposed to make recommendations on how to replace the revenues lost through MSP, and the provincial government kind of preempted their report by just making decisions and announcing them in the budget. So that was something people didn't expect. I mean, the employer health tax that will be introduced next January fully replaces the 50% cut to MSP that we saw last month.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that revenue is going to be fully replaced. And on top of that, it partially replaces some of the revenues from the remaining 50%, which will be cut in 2020, mm-hmm. but not fully. Overall, at this stage, the government is going to, if nothing else changes, the government is going to be short about $700 million a year.
Okay.
However, my expectation is that, the MSP task force will report in the end of March when the report is due, and their recommendations will be used to announce other measures to replace the remainder of the MSP, and those will be announced probably in next year's budget and will come into effect in 2020 when the MSP is eliminated.
Right.
Okay. Well, I just have a quick question just to clarify. So I'm just wondering, where exactly is the money that's being collected through the speculation tax and the increased empty home tax going towards? Is there anyone in particular?
The way taxes work in British Columbia is that they don't go towards specific things.
Okay.
Really. All the revenue goes towards in a big fund for government, and then they spend it on all their priorities. But
okay.
If you compare then the increase in taxes from those housing measures, housing new taxes, to, say, the increased investment in affordable housing, you can make an argument that, okay, it's going towards housing, but, it's going towards helping fund all the priorities.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Maybe just one final question.
Yeah, Iglika, just on a final note, so do you have any criticisms of this budget?
Like from your own perspective?
Of course. No budget is perfect. There were two items that were notably missing, and that was action, more significant action to help those living in poverty specifically. I wish there were increases to disability assistance rates and welfare rates. We know that those remain thousands of dollars below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. Now, the government is in the process of consulting to develop a poverty reduction plan, and new legislation is supposed to come in September or in the fall. So essentially what this budget does is it asks the poorest British Columbians to wait mm-hmm. for next
right.
year's budget to see a benefit. It's not going to happen. It's just that, I really think that those people have waited long enough and we could have afforded to help them. And what the government chose instead is to balance the budget and to show a surplus on the books
mm-hmm.
And to help those living in poverty immediately.
Right, prioritize
right.
them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. These are all complicated issues, but thank you so much for simplifying this for us.
Yes.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cool. And so stay tuned for our upcoming story on the National Day of Action on the overdose crisis. This was a rally that took place downtown on Tuesday, calling for the decriminalization of drugs and criminal justice reform as it relates to drug users. We'll be right back with more local news on Democracy Watch after this short break. Stay tuned.
The BC government now covers medications that could reduce your chances of contracting HIV by 90%. PREP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis and is a preventative measure that HIV-negative folks can take to reduce their risk of becoming positive. Health Initiative for Men suggests that if you have had sex with a partner with HIV, have had a recent STI, have multiple sexual partners, have a history of inconsistent or no condom use, are currently involved in sex work, or have had repeated courses of post-exposure prophylaxis, then you might want to think about looking into PrEP measures. CATR and Discorder are not medical professionals. Please refer to your doctor for more information.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just finished an interview with Aglika Ivanova, a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and she broke down the NDP's 2018 budget for us. We are now turning our attention to a story on the National Day of Action, which took place on Tuesday. This reporting was done by myself, Alex DeBoer, and Ryan Patrick Jones. We attended a rally that started at Victory Square and walked up to the Supreme Courts, the provincial courts at near Hornby and Granville. And so Ryan edited and produced this piece based on the reporting we did.
Extraordinary.
He did an amazing job. I'm so excited to play this. So let's take a listen.
I'm standing in Victory Square Park at the corner of West Hastings and Canby Streets in downtown Vancouver. Groups of people are milling about, chatting and smoking cigarettes. The smell of weed in the air is prominent, but this isn't any ordinary day in the downtown East Side. A microphone and speakers are being set up at the top of the stairs in the center of the park. A circle has formed around a group of drummers. Four women are holding signs saying, "Moms, stop the harm." One of them, Kat Vahama, tells me why she's here. What brings you here today?
Well, many things. Predominantly, I lost my son to fentanyl poisoning in August of 2016. And we need to have a complete paradigm shift on how we deal with drug use, addiction. It is a health crisis that we're dealing with. And shame, blame, and incarceration are not the way to help people.
Today is the second annual National Day of Action on the overdose crisis. In the last 2 years, the number of deaths in British Columbia from drug overdoses has tripled, with more than 1,400 people dying last year. The synthetic opiate fentanyl is being blamed for the spike in deaths. Today, around 200 activists, drug users, and drug policy reform advocates have gathered here to urge the government to change its approach to drug use. The focus of the rally is the criminal justice system and the harmful effects it has on those who use drugs.
Well, we're VANDU, Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Oh, okay, cool.
And we represent VANDU drug users, and mostly people who are ODing, right?
Yeah.
We're here for the National Day of Action. This is happening in every city across Canada. So, we want the politicians to make drug policy that works for the people, right?
The rally was organized by Jordan Westfall, president of the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs. He's a recovered opioid addict who just completed his master's in public policy at Simon Fraser University. Here he is speaking to the crowd.
We are going to see 4,000 people die this year needlessly because of the overdose epidemic and because of the criminalization of people who use drugs. This needs to end immediately. And the only way it'll end if we raise our voices.
The people gathered here are calling for the decriminalization of all drugs and for government resources to be transferred from enforcement of drug laws to treatment of health and addiction issues. In an interview at the rally, Westfall lays out his organization's demands.
We need to decriminalize drugs. We need to cut the Ministry of Justice's budget and divert that money into supports into harm reduction and overdose prevention. And we need to eliminate charges from people's criminal records for nonviolent offenders.
David Houck, a board member of VANDU and a longtime resident of the downtown East Side, agrees. He argues the government should legalize and regulate the drug supply.
End prohibition. Have a clean drug supply. Clean and safe drugs. That's the only way this will end. And it's been proven in Sweden, other European countries. And you know what? They're always talking about abstinence. Well, guess what? part of the thing that came out of that they didn't even expect is they're like 40% abstinence now in people over there. You know what I mean? They changed their lives. They don't have to run around trying to, do a $400 day drug habit, so the crime goes down. It's a win-win, and and winning is like having lives saved. That's what I feel.
The question of arresting people for drug possession is raised by Susan Boyd, a drug policy researcher at the University of Victoria. Like many others here, she advocates a harm reduction approach.
In the midst of an overdose death public health crisis, why are we arresting anyone for drug possession? Why aren't we today decriminalizing personal possession of all drugs and rolling out better heroin-assisted treatment programs, stimulant programs, overdose prevention sites across Canada?
The people gathered here also want law enforcement to put an end to red zoning, the practice whereby people accused of low-level drug crimes are prohibited from traveling to certain areas as part of their bail conditions. Many argue red zoning prevents marginalized people from accessing vital social and health services, many of which are concentrated in the downtown east side. This is Spike from the Overdose Prevention Society.
All things should be illegal. All of it should be illegal. People's rights are not taken into consideration at all. How do you stop a person from... This is the highest poverty area in the city. How do you stop people from going here when this is where all the services are? It's criminal.
Red zoning is both disruptive and detrimental to vulnerable groups, says Caitlin Shane. She's a community engagement lawyer with the Pivot Legal Society. She outlines some of the legal issues facing drug users.
So what we're seeing is criminalization of drugs and criminalization of people who use drugs. Our overarching goal is to see legalization and regulation, but in the interim we feel that there needs to be a strong push from the federal government to decriminalize possession of drugs, so long as people are still under threat of arrest and of dealing with the court system when they're using drugs, they're no longer safe. And we need to be creating an environment where people who use drugs are safe.
And what is red zoning?
Red zoning is a situation where it's often a condition of bail or a condition of a charge where a person is geographically restricted from a certain location. And we're seeing research and studies that are showing that oftentimes people are actually prohibited from entering zones where there are very necessary health services, doctor's offices, methadone clinics, social services, community organizations that people frequent, and they're receiving these conditions that actually prevent them from going to those places, and that's having a whole host of other health-related effects on people.
And so I heard a lot of people, so is this something that's only given out by judges?
It's something that is administered through the court system, but we're also seeing it happening by police officers, and that's something called long forming, and it's really problematic because oftentimes police are telling people that they can't go to certain spaces, but there's no real record of that. So there's no reliable way to track how often this is happening, and people don't necessarily know their rights, and people are feeling that they can't go to the places that they need to in order to be safe and to use safely.
And so how does that play out on a day-to-day basis for people who have been red zoned? Like, how is it enforced?
Yeah, so we hear from a lot of folks about the impact that this has on their lives, and primarily it means that they're prevented from going to the places where, again, they feel safe. So whether that is a community space like Vandu or a health service or a doctor's office or a methadone clinic, oftentimes these red zones are administered and people are given a certain amount of time during the day where they can access, where they are able to access those services. But if they miss that window, which is often the case if you don't have an alarm clock or you don't have the same sort of luxuries that a lot of people do have who have housing, people are missing those windows, and then they're being further criminalized for just trying to access services that they really need.
And so what needs to change?
We need to see a lot of things change. We need to see government taking the idea of legalization and regulation seriously. And we need to see decriminalization in the interim, so at the very bare minimum, people can be safe when they use drugs. We need to see the provinces expanding access to things like heroin-assisted treatment and opioid substitution therapies. We need local police departments to adopt policies of non-attendance to overdoses. We need local police departments to deprioritize possession charges. And we really just need to see the federal government take seriously its claim that it's treating drug use as a health issue and not a criminal matter.
After a round of speeches, the rally-goers begin marching to the provincial law courts, where drug crimes are prosecuted in downtown Vancouver. Led by a convoy of police motorcycles, marchers make their way down Pender Street to Howe Street, doing their best to make sure their message is heard.
No more drug war!
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 They arrive at the law courts, and it's time for more speeches.
You know, they don't realize what they take away when they just say, you can't go there because you're going to get drugs. Let's get real, people. Doesn't matter where you put me, I'm going to get my drugs.
Yeah.
I use drugs, and I ain't ashamed to say it. And there ain't nothing wrong with me.
A man from a group called Culture Saves Lives brings attention to the ongoing legacy of colonialism in Canada.
There's injustice in this country. And it's called Canada. Today, their spokesperson is Trudeau. Today, the Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people, settlers and people of all walks of life, join hands to stand up, to have love and compassion for one another. Love and compassion for those who are hurt, those who have been oppressed, and those who have been inflicted upon. Genocide after genocide, generation after generation. They change the names, they change the laws that benefit themselves. And we pay the price. Shame on them.
There's a man in a baseball cap who's been standing silently throughout the entire event. He's holding a picture of a young boy. When asked about the picture, he explains.
This is Joe Evans. He's 29 years old, and I know him for about 9 years. He's been off and on living on the streets, and he's local in downtown Eastside. He's had a tragic life when he was very young, around 20 years. What got him into addiction was a tragedy that happened with his mom, and after his mom passed away, it went downhill with him. So he has been struggling for many, many years. He's been living in the streets and living in shelters.
And so what happened to Joel?
He was found in the Balmoral Hotel. That's where he OD'd, in one of the washrooms, and unfortunately in one of the hotels there. It's a haven for drug addicts where they go there and to use and stuff.
Stories like this are all too common in Vancouver, especially on the downtown east side. Indigenous peoples are especially hard hit by the overdose crisis. The First Nations Health Authority found that Indigenous people account for 10% of all opioid deaths in BC, despite making up only 3.4% of the population. Eventually, the crowd locks hands and forms a human chain spanning the sidewalk and the footsteps of the courthouse.
Go to the bottom step and lock arms around this courthouse. We are going to red zone the courthouse.
The human chain is meant to symbolize a red zone of the type forced upon those who run afoul of the law. The rally-goers even try to get the police to join.
Come on. Come join hands.
The National Day of Action ends with a group of singers and drummers sharing their music from the center of the symbolic red zone on the footsteps of the provincial law courts. Despite the challenges facing many in the downtown east side, whether it's poverty, drug addiction, or mental health, the people who live and spend time there find strength in community, in each other.
We're all one people down here, and we are one. And we're all together. We are family.
All right. right. We're back. That was a report from Tuesday's National Day of Action on Drug Decriminalization held at Victory Square Park and in front of the Supreme Courts in downtown Vancouver. Thank you again to News Collective member Ryan Patrick Jones for all his blood, sweat, and tears. Next, we have a collection of voices from a fundraiser and educational night held at the Unitarian Church of Vancouver. This tape was collected by News Collective member Christina Song. She also edited and produced the piece. Let's take a listen.
Withstands the weather. Well, anyone can do it alone, but we're stronger together. Like links in a steel chain.
There is an urgent situation facing British Columbians. Marine Harvest Canada, the largest Atlantic salmon fish farming company in British Columbia, is waiting to see if their Atlantic salmon farming tenure will be renewed this June. Some scientists argue that open-net salmon farms, which are used off the coast of British Columbia by Marine Harvest Canada, endanger local wild salmon population by increasing their chances of disease. Opponents of fish farming believe such aquaculture operations, which largely raise Atlantic salmon, devastate wild Pacific salmon stocks by transferring disease and parasites. Open net systems allow water to flow freely between pens holding farmed fish and the natural marine environment. On the other hand, there has been significant pushback from salmon farmers in BC, who warn that many jobs hang in the balance if farming tenures in this $800 million industry are not sustained.
We can do it alone, but we're stronger together, like links in a steel chain.
On Friday, February 16th, a fundraiser for environmental groups against salmon farming was held inside the Unitarian Church of Vancouver. It featured impassioned speakers such as Ernest Alfred, the hereditary chief of the Namgis First Nations, and Julia McIntyre-Smith, a First Nations activist based in Squamish, BC. The event also featured David Suzuki, the award-winning scientist and broadcaster for the CBC. The participants appealed for the public to join them in protesting open-net salmon farms, which have led to Atlantic salmon escaping into the Pacific. Here's David Suzuki.
You're bringing in something that is going to have very, very profound ecological consequences. That invasive species are very, very, very debilitating. An act of faith. The DFO, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, says Atlantic salmon can't reproduce. So even if they escape, don't worry. So we've had escapes by the thousands over the past 30 years. And last year, as you know, there was, 300,000 that escaped in Washington State. And John Volpe, a professor at the University of Victoria, for his PhD thesis years ago, found that, in fact, Atlantic salmon are spawning in British Columbia waters. DFO's immediate response when he reported that was, I'll bet you environmentalists like the Suzukis are planting them. So we've got a government that's gotten really weird. Its priority seems to be protecting established powers rather than going, oh my God, you know, we got to do it. It's the wrong response.
Just last August, Hereditary Chief Ernest Alfred led a group of protesters to a sit-in on a farm on Swanson Island owned by Marine Harvest Canada.
I want DFO fired. We now have the internal documents that implicate DFO working with industry, directly hiding it and trying to cover up the disease we call Pisemuria virus.
Julia McIntyre-Smith, speaker and Indigenous activist, spoke passionately about the traditional cultural and spiritual connection that BC's First Nations communities have with the salmon and wild salmon fishing.
Our people have had an incredibly deep connection to our traditional territories and our lands and our waters. And as my grandma tells me, this deep connection is founded on the basis of four traditional laws. And they're more complex, but I've broken them down to the importance of spirituality, the importance of all of creation, the importance of relationships, and the importance of self. And I just really want to highlight the importance of relationship. We can't live without all of creation, but all of creation can live without us. And so we need to be humble in our relationship with the earth, with the animals, with the water and the lands. We can't be dictators over the lands. We need to work alongside the lands. And I believe Our ancestors did do that. They figured that relationship out. They lived cohesively and deeply ingrained within our culture and within the land.
The event was attended by many prominent First Nations activists such as Quetzal Tattle of the Stolo, also known as Patricia Kelly. Kelly has been in and out of court battles with the Crown over her right to fish off the coast of British Columbia as an Indigenous person.
Hi, yes, I am Quetzal Tattle, K-W-I-T-S-E-L, Tattle, T-A-T-E-L, and I am Stolo Coast Salish. From 1996 all the way to 2013, from my children's baby years to their adult years, I spent in court, an unusual place to raise your children, away from the fish, away from the land. And this is a strategy of Canada. Every time they divide us up and divide us away from our resources, it's harming our chances to have a decent life on our own lands with no treaty.
How would you respond to the government saying we need these resources now for jobs now?
I say piss off with that concept that we need these jobs now, because they're dead-end jobs, they're short-term policies. The policies that we need are 1,000 years, not 100 years or 150-year policies. We have had so many resources that we could do our artwork. We have fish, water, logs, minerals. All these things that we have, we must protect. So with the policies that we have right now, we will not have our resources. We must take a new look at hemp lands, not tar sands. We must look at our own tourism and value the beauty of what we call Canada today.
Democracy Watch had a chance to speak to Chief Alfred about his experience in protesting the salmon farming industry and about the federal and provincial government's involvement in the matter.
My name is Kwakwa Balas. My English name is Ernest Alfred, and I'm from the Namqis at Alert Bay.
And what is your role within the fight against salmon farming?
On August 24th, that's nearly 6 months ago, we declared an occupation. My niece and myself went out to Swanson Island Fish Farm, and we brought our tents and our sleeping bags, and we decided that we were going to sit there and we were going to wait until we had some clear answers about the 10-year licenses that the province has issued so these farms could operate. Now, it's a multi-jurisdictional mess because they've broken up the responsibilities between the federal government and the provincial government. But when we realized that all of the farms within the Broughton Archipelago are expiring and that the province has the authority to not renew them, we became very excited, and there's a glimmer of hope here. But we're really hopeful and we're excited because the provincial government has taken certain steps to, you know, reconcile with First Nations people. And they speak a different language than the previous governments that we've had. And so I'm very optimistic and feeling quite powerful that we are, in fact, winning this fight against this Norwegian companies.
Sorry, could you clarify, are you talking about the new NDP Green Party government?
Absolutely. John Horgan came to the Big House on October 10th and heard our people in our ceremony house. And, I don't believe that Christy Clark ever would have come to our Big House. And I think if she did, she probably would have showed up with a visi vest and a hard hat on. So it's a new way that our people are not used to. The fact that he came and he brought his ministers and he heard us for over 4 hours talk about the dangers of fish farming in our territory. So the message is very loud and clear, and the solution is also really loud and clear.
The BC NDP government sent a warning letter to Marine Harvest Canada last October stating that the renewal of their tenure is uncertain. The newly elected government declared their intent to abide by the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. This declaration stipulates that the use of natural resources must have the consent of First Nations people. The NDP government's Minister of Transportation, Claire Trevena, campaigned last year on the promise to rid BC of salmon farms. However, Julia McIntyre-Smith isn't sure if the new provincial government will deliver on their promises. She spoke to Democracy Watch about the state of salmon farming.
The relationship with the government has always been tense. They have made all these broken promises, all these empty promises to Indigenous communities about nation-to-nation relationship. Any apology they have made has been empty. The walk hasn't reflected that apology afterward. I know there was some hope when the Liberal government got voted in that maybe we would start to see a change, but it seems status quo on their part. They say the right words. They do good PR stunts. But really, there's no backbone to their actions. And same thing with NDP government in BC. The woman, Claire Trevena, who is elected in the riding that a lot of my family lives up in the North Island, she came into our big house and she said she was going to get fish farms out of our territories. She made that promise before she was elected. And because of that, we got her elected. Our votes got her where she is. And now we just haven't seen really much from her.
The state of salmon farms in BC is far from being resolved. Many will continue to wait with bated breath on the government's June decision over whether or not to renew Marine Harvest Canada's fish farm tenure. Many salmon farmers in BC fear that if the tenure is not renewed, jobs will be lost and the industry will suffer. You got to know how to keep the cycle
going, keep the cycle going. All right, back with Democracy Watch. That was a story reported and produced by Christina Song. Really excellent work. So many really great pre-produced pieces by the News Collective this week. I am very proud. It's important to note with this piece that the funds raised at this educational night and information session went to First Nations activists involved and not the Unitarian Church itself. Also, important to note is that Democracy Watch did reach out to the Department of Oceans and Fisheries and were forwarded to an email and did not hear back. Additionally, we did reach out to Marine Harvest Canada, who did call us back, but we did not have time to interview them for this show. So that is today's show. Thank you very much for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.